background and professional and personal experience that informs the work, and what does it mean to have more experiences at the table. So when I got to the council, I talked about criminal justice reform. I talked about reentry. I talked about folks who are currently behind the walls, meaning prison. I talked about the effects of trauma from having a parent who was incarcerated. My father was incarcerated for the first 8 years of my life. So you bring, I think, unique experiences and stories to the conversation. I talk about persistent inequities in the city of Boston, not just using my personal story to highlight it, but to talk about, you know, Dorchester and Mattapan continue to be left behind in many respects when it comes to quality schools, access to transportation, good jobs, closing the wealth gaps. So naming that. And lastly, I talk about race and racism and busing. In order for us to truly grapple with the tough issues plaguing us today, that historical context is important. And we have to name it. And government really has to name it, given that it was a perpetrator of injustice for some time. So what does it mean to truly name that? And I'm not afraid to do that. I actually bring the council through racial equity training. That was one of my goals as council president, to have everyone grapple with race and racism and understanding these terms we sometimes just throw around, and equity and inequity and quality. You know, what does it mean to the difference between equity and equality? And so I think that, just for me, is important. But I think if I weren't there, we wouldn't be necessarily having that conversation, and I'm sure everyone can highlight some specifics too.
I'm not going to ask you to name any names. Were you surprised by the reaction for the questions that you got when you were doing this training?
The racial equity training?
Yes.
So I started in February of last year trying to get funding for it. Most of the money that comes into government goes to their side or the administrative side. And I said, well, what about this incredible legislative branch of government called the Boston City Council? Can we get some money? And so I went to the foundations and said, you know, Boston Foundation, you're putting out these reports about inequities and closing gaps. Well, I need your money to help bring my council through this training so that we have the tools to address these inequities together. It's one thing to talk about it, but we need to understand that, sort of have a shared understanding, to have the tools to address the issues. So people are excited, and it's not just for the counselors, it's gonna be for the staff and the team that also work with us and support us, which I think is incredibly important.
I think one of the things I'm excited about when it comes to local government and some of the things that's happening both at nationally, and thankfully not in our state house, the friction that exists in government, I think, is force people to think locally about how to solve problems, the ability to get things done. And I'm a huge fan of local government. If you think about the services you rely on as a constituent, the most important services that you rely on get delivered at the local level, whether it's educating your kids, keeping your neighborhood safe, those great spaces, those great places in your community where you make memories or really enjoy a high quality of life, those are all delivered at the local level. And for being the first woman mayor in my community, to think that those important conversations, those important discussions related to those very services that align on most directly. I joke that we never have a shutdown of local government. You know, this federal shutdown would never happen at the local level. Try not picking up someone's trash for one day, right? Or a school being closed, and it's just unheard of. It's also nonpartisan. So we're not necessarily caught in ideological conversations about services that people are relying on. And to think that Salem, almost 400 years old, in 2026, we'll be celebrating our quadricentennial, there was not a female CEO of our community involved in the discussion about those delivery of those services that we rely on so much. Today we have a female school superintendent, a female police chief, a number of senior leadership positions are women. I've been mayor for 14 years. During that time frame, I've had an opportunity to see the number of female elected mayors increase. It kind of ebbs and flows, but when we sit around and have had conversations with other female women, they're running because they see other women in office. So I think there's something that happens when you see somebody else who can do it. 3 kids, 3, 5, and 8 when I was elected. So if you see other people engaging in these conversations, you see yourself doing it, and I think it's so important that we have that perspective around the table, and when we're talking about these very important services that are happening at the local level. And I think women in particular are a little more used to getting involved at the local level, and I'm really grateful for the position that I have, but also to be able to help see other people in these roles as well.
So if anyone questions for 1 second her passion for local government, let me just tell you, if I had a nickel for every time I asked Kim Driscoll if she was interested in this office, that office, any higher office that's opening up, she always turned to me, she said, I don't think so. Your name is floated around more than probably anybody that I know for at least 15 other offices that have come up over the last 5 years.
Fresh perspectives, different backgrounds make for richer conversations and more innovative solutions. And it's a privilege but also a burden to be the first, because I don't want this to come off as I'm speaking for all Vietnamese American women. I'm not. But I do think, to your point, that we are setting an example. We are here, and it's good for younger students to see people who look like them, who speak like them. And we, as women of color, we have a different way of governing. We have, we need to find our authentic voice. And that's something that we can pass along to other women. I'm here because I've spoken to other women who've run and asked them what worked for you that might not work for a man running, for instance. And so the bigger the bench, the better it is. And we need to not only pull up a chair, you know, pull up a chair at the table, but we need to pull up more chairs for others to come behind us as well.
Yeah, I guess I'll go. For me, what I bring is I grew up in Chelsea, and I fell into the street culture that often sucks many of our young people in urban communities like Chelsea. I had an opportunity to work as a young youth worker, and so I saw firsthand the issues and how policy is made at a national level, how it trickles down to my backyard, and how it affected people in my neighborhood, in my village. And so that's a unique perspective that I can bring to the table. But I also feel that it's a lot of times when we talk diversity, we think race, and we scan the room to look for diversity. But it also has to be in terms of class and religion and race and disability, and in the many ways that, you know, women intersects with so many other vulnerable communities. Because if we're just talking about, you know, women, that's only half the conversation. And so that's something that I always stay mindful of, always trying to stay connected to all of the vulnerable communities, regardless of whether or not I speak their language. I'll find a way to connect with them. My Muslim community, I'm figuring out a way to connect with them. It just a way to lift. I just feel like it's incumbent upon us as women to speak from a place that's heart-centered, to be vulnerable, and to just be open to be inclusive. I think that our male counterparts failed at doing that, and it's up to us to be able to bring more voices to the table. To ask permission. It's very in your face, the patriarchy. Of what a woman politician should look like or act like or speak like. You know, I show up to council meetings and sometimes I wear jeans and sneakers, and that's okay because there isn't a dress code. And again, I was elected just like you. And so I show up and, you know, people look at you up and down, and you just have to put your shoulders back and you stand there with pride and, yes, I was elected just like you. And just continue just the judgment. Authentically, you just go ahead and do it. It doesn't matter what you're wearing, where you come from, what neighborhood you live in. If I can do it, anybody can do it. And so that's my story. Thank you.
This is true for being in office, but also during the campaign. I feel like because we don't have enough diversity in government, I have to really prove myself, because the assumption is, she doesn't, exactly to your point, she does not look like a typical politician. So you have to work so much harder to prove yourself and constantly prove yourself. So I find myself talking about my degree and how I went to law school, so I must know something. And these are things that are just not assumed right off the bat when someone looks at me. And the other assumption is that because I may look different than people, they think that I don't understand where they're coming from. But at the end of the day, we're in the same community. We care about the same things: schools, healthcare, transportation. These are things that we have in common. We need to find common values. But that's not a student first. So that was why it was so important for me to go door to door twice so that people could see me from who I am and ask me questions and get to know me as a person. And it's the same thing now. I need to build these relationships face to face, person by person, to show them that I know what I'm talking about and that we share a lot more in common than differences.
So when I arrived at the State House, there have been over 20,000 men who served in the legislature. When I was elected in 2015, there had only been 197 women in our state's history. And I thought, I'm going to make appointments to go talk to some of the women who have managed to get ahead here and just sort of figure out what the secret was. So I made an appointment with Speaker Pro Tem Pat Haddock, who's the highest ranking woman in the House. And, you know, she shared, immediately welcomed me in, shared a lot with me about what her experience had been there. And it was really, for her, it was two things. It was hard work and always being prepared. But she also operated from the perspective that she knew when she was in a meeting as the only woman that she wasn't just sitting there representing herself, that she felt that sense that I'm here as all women who are here. So I always need to be on my game. I need to be contributing. And then I met with Harriet Chandler. She was the Senate Majority Leader. And, you know, I shared with her, you know, I want to meet with her, I want to understand what, and she goes, oh, no, it's very easy. You just really have to work hard. She used another term. But you just need to work hard. Like, that's what you need to do. And I left both of their offices thinking, okay, well, I'm a hard worker, so, you know, this isn't, I guess I thought there was going to be some big reveal about how, as a woman, you got ahead here. And it was, I guess, in some ways, very reassuring. It was about being a hard worker and showing up and illustrating what you're capable of. And I have found that there. I have found that, you know, if you are recognized as somebody who is going to do the hard work, then you are going to get the respect of your colleagues. And so I find that to be a good news story. I'm also, one of the things I expected when I arrived at the State House, we talk so much outside of the building about Republicans and Democrats, which is funny in one way, because that's not even half of enrollment in Massachusetts. The majority of people are unenrolled. So whenever I hear the word bipartisan, I think you just left out half of the electorate in that conversation because they don't necessarily identify as Republican or Democrat. But people think that is sort of how we align ourselves, and that you sort of walk around the building with an R or a D emblazoned on your head, and that is how you all greet each other, and that is how you are recognized. And again, I really found that the the vibe is much more, who are the people who are there, to your point, who all got elected the same way, but who really want to put their head down and do the hard work, representing their constituents and being part of policy discussions. And then there's a few people who are just there because they're really enamored with the fact that they're serving in that position. The good news is there's not that many of that group. For the most part, you know, I get excited to go to work every day because I get to work with many different people on many different issues. And so I sometimes wish that the way, and it is certainly different from the national level, I think, but in Massachusetts, we really go to do the work that we got elected to do. And we work in a very productive and collegial environment. And we'll tell you sometimes, I joke that the pace at the State House is a pace only a man would love. Because as women, we really want to accomplish a lot, and sometimes you don't. But I love this opportunity, and I think it is like many things in life, it is what you need it. And so if you want to put your head down and work hard and seek out opportunities to get involved,
I'd say for me, two of the things that, especially as a new mayor, that were challenges, I'd say there were two things. One was work-life balance. I mentioned I had three kids, 3, 5, and 8. You are newly elected, and everybody wants you to be at everything. And if you're a people pleaser, you want to try and be at everything. So for the first few months, I was trying to be at everything, and really quickly realized I got to get a hold of my schedule and lay down some rules just for my own sanity and to make sure I had that balance, especially with young kids. So I think that was really important, like the reckoning of, okay, wait, this is my schedule. I need to make sure certain things are on it that I want to do, not all the things that people want to see me. There's this responsibility that comes with office. You definitely want to recognize that, but there's also this responsibility with at home and family. And that was really, really critical for those first 6 months joining them. The second thing that stood out to me was someone who's a leader, and certainly when you're mayor, you have to make decisions like every single day, right? Sometimes folks love those decisions, sometimes they don't, but a decision needs to be made. And as the first female making those decisions, I think people sometimes confuse somebody making a decision that you don't agree with as headstrong, not listening. When, no, we had a really good conversation. I heard everything that you said. I really appreciated that. And I just disagreed. Start to view leadership differently, I think, depending if somebody's wearing a skirt or a pair of pants. And some of those terms get thrown away. And I think we have to remind ourselves that that being a leader is exhibiting these skills, and it really doesn't matter whether you're in heels or flats making those decisions. And we want somebody making decisions. I think it's working in my community. I've been grateful to be elected 4 times and had a lot of support. So I think people actually want decisions being made and like having a positive aspect happening in their community. But early on, that was a big switch for folks, that somebody's making a decision and they're making a decision that not everybody agrees with, and we're going to move forward.
I'll just add all of that. All of that. But I think, you know, on the work-life balance, you know, I've got an 18-month-old at home, and I'm not going to be rude tonight, but if I run out those doors, it's because I want to go kiss my son before he goes to bed. And I think standing and owning that and not feeling guilty, you know, it helps when your constituents also understand and respect that. And I'm blessed to represent districts and residents who do, but it can be really challenging when you run into folks who are like, I've invited you to this event, and I invited you yesterday, and I'm like, yes, I booked this months ago, you know, so it can be really challenging. But I'll add something that I think many have heard Congressman Presley speak of, which is, you know, not all women, not all black women, for example, are a monolith. we're not all the same. And so I think whether we call this a barrier or not, it sometimes can be really challenging if you go into a space and people think, I'm the same person as Congresswoman Presley or Councillor Edwards or Councillor Janey, because we all identify as Black women. We each come with unique experiences and backgrounds and passions for the work that are different, and we work to support each other. But I think, you know, it's great to have more women, but to remember that we're not all the same. And I'll add to that a conversation I just had earlier today with a young woman of color. What does it mean for women to support other women? Some folks really, I'm not just naming that because it can be a challenge in our community, particularly in the city of Boston. I see some people clap in silence. You can clap loud on that. Women supporting women across every demographic. I wouldn't be here if I didn't have white women who believed in me, Latina women believing in me. My chief of staff, Ellie, is a Latina. She's somewhere in the middle. To trust and love one another authentically, and to demonstrate that for our young girls, because I think they see the energy in the room, and sometimes it may be great, and sometimes it's not. This is great because, you know, we had conversations in the back, and you created this space for us. Some of us just met for the first time, but women need to support other women, and they need to do it authentically.
You know, I'm not a politician, I've never run for office, but I have been covering politicians for a very long time. And I will say, when I first started in 1973 as a reporter at the State House, there were, I think, 4 women legislators, and there were mostly men that were at least 20 to 25 years older than I was. And most of them would not give me an interview, they would even stop to answer my question. I was working for United Press International at the time. But I learned, eventually, that the best way to get someone to talk to me was to go to the younger, newer legislators, the guys that were not too much older than I was. I remember two of them. One was named Andy Card, and we know what happened there. And the other one was Phil Johnston. That's right. And they were thrilled to be interviewed by anybody because they were just to her, and I said, hey, have you seen this?
And she was so appreciative that someone actually fought to send her something on something she was interested in. I'm like, yeah, that's what we want to do. Like, you know, we hear that you're interested in something and try and find ways to include it. So I have found,
and there will be payback for that. I mean, you know, eventually someday she'll be able to do something for someone else who might be able to help you with something. And you never know about those things.
No, and I think, you know, and I don't, that's not an exclusive women thing. I mean, there are men at the State House who are very good colleagues who do the same, so I don't want to make it sound as if it's not. But I find in particular that we recognize that that's one of the things that we can do for each other, is to find ways to be supportive of what our individual priorities are.
Let's move this conversation a little bit onto the national level. Elizabeth Warren has latched on her beloved dog, Bailey, as the campaign mom mascot. She tweets about a lot, Instagram a lot. As a woman, do you think we need something even more than most male candidates that captures the voters' imagination to get into their political doorway, to capture their imagination? Is it harder for women, and is it in a sense a double standard, if it is? It's a question that I ask because we have for the first time so many women running for the top office, and I'm sitting there watching the different strategies and the different ways that they are all trying to separate themselves from the group. Do you think it's hard, or do you think it's not much different?
I think it's harder. I don't think it's necessary. I think that a lot of times we, as women, internalize what we think power is supposed to look like. And a lot of these ways that we try to adhere is really oppressive, patriarchal ideologies that really we no longer have to serve anymore. I am a large woman. I am a Puerto Rican woman. I have frizzy hair. I like hip hop. I show up.
To Miss Warren's dog Bailey, but I don't think I need to take any pictures with mine. I don't need any props. I don't think I need any makeup. I don't think I need anything extra, because I think that showing up with integrity and authenticity is all that I need to serve.
Okay, lots of tips. And more women, that I would see a 50% female Congress before I die. I'm 68 years old, so it's not a lot of time.
I think we're seeing this resurgence of so many younger women in particular who are exactly looking at themselves and seeing an opportunity to really change the world. Like this Me Too moment, I just think back years before, people just took it, right? You had to endure. And this generation is not enduring. They say enough. And,
sure that we have have gender parity in all different areas, we need to talk about building a pipeline from the local level, because that's how you build your base. All politics is local, but also we need to make sure that young girls can see themselves in all different positions. It doesn't have to be an elected position. Like you were saying, work on an issue. If you're passionate about gun safety, do that. If you're passionate about environment, do that. But be there, and show up for other women. And one of the other things that I like to remind my supporters in my piece is that we need to give each other a positive reinforcement, because women tend to be so critical on ourselves. So we need to hear that. We need to remind one another, you're doing a great job, Andrea. and so for those out there, that's really helpful to us, because we want to make sure that we're doing the right thing, and we want to hear that every once in a while.
So we want to leave a little bit of time for Q&A from you, but before I go ask you the first question, I'm going to ask you the same question I just asked Ms. Winter. How many of you think that there will be a 50% women in Congress before I die? It's pretty good. I wish the rest of the population agrees with that. Okay, we're going to take some questions. Let's take a couple from up there. There are a couple of folks, I think, with microphones. And all I ask is that you tell us what your name is, what city or town you're from, and then if you want to direct the question to someone specifically, tell us who it is. And we'll start with the woman there at the very top. Yes.
Hello, my name is Anya Shani. I'm from Somerville. And I became American citizen, U.S. citizen in November. And so I'm very excited. I'm extremely interested in running for office too, but my question is very practical. I don't even know how to get started. Like, practical tips would be very appreciated.
To run for office, you mean?
Yes.
Right, to run for office. Was to handle this one?
I'll take this one. So, did you hear the sponsors earlier today? One of which is Emerge. I did the boot camp, but there's an amazing 6-month program. And what I got from that is the nuts and bolts of what are the different pieces. And as a woman, I think I speak to all of us here, we like to know what we're getting ourselves into. So it's really helpful to see all the different parts and to work at putting all those pieces together. So I highly recommend you seeking that out. But I think other groups are also wonderful in having different training and program all around. Please come to me after. I have a whole list for you. But this is the time to do it too. Even if you are not running, if you're not going to run anytime soon, it's good to know so that you can put yourself in that position when the opportunity arrives.
Or at least get on a campaign for someone who is planning one. Learn how it all starts from the grassroots level. Other questions? Anybody else up there that would like to ask a question?
Right here, behind you.
Oh, great! Wonderful.
Well, good evening. My name is Ronkia Baker Gomez. And I've been a political operator for many years. I've worked in state government. I've worked in local office. But my question is for Council President Andre. Here's my question. Of the 351 cities and towns in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Boston is the only one that does not have an elected school committee. Would you say, well, let me just say, in my experience, most women that get started in politics, start at the less visible positions. And that position would be on the school committee. And in the city of Boston, we have a history of men and women graduating up in office, starting with the school committee. So, and also in our public schools, we don't have civic education. When I graduated from Boston Public Schools, the best experience I ever had was my civic classes. And I think we're not serving our young people well by not having real civic classes and really talking about the importance of an elected school committee and what that does in terms of engaging young people. So I'd like to hear your stance on that.
Thank you for the work you've done, and thank you for the question. So I'll start with the civics piece, and I have to give credit to my new colleague, Councilor Garrison, who also file a hearing order on this and just have a hearing on the importance of civics in the schools. You know, I had a Latin school in the ninth grade. Mr. Myers actually was a male, black male teacher. Another issue, lack of diversity in our teachers. So it's a big deal and it makes a difference. On the school committee piece, it's not an issue right now that I'm grappling with. I'm actually doing almost like a survey within my district. There are folks who feel strongly that it should be elected and not appointed, because I think the appointed school committee gets sort of rubber stamped by the mayor. There's a subset of folks who think it should remain appointed because of the history of an elected school committee in the city of Boston. And then there's some who actually added a third question: do we need a school committee? So it's something that, you know, I give Councilor Sabi George, who chairs the education committee, credit for taking on the conversation, and it's a conversation we're still continuing. And I actually have some folks who formerly served on the school committee who live in my district who are mixed about where we should go. But I agree with you, locals, whether the school committee or the Boston City Council, obviously look at Congressman Presley. Most folks don't pay attention to the local level. We are doing incredible work. This is where it starts. This is where the pipeline starts. So folks, when you're thinking about supporting candidates, don't just look at the presidential candidates. Give to the local level. Sometimes it's really hard to get people to give at the local level. Your money goes a lot farther, frankly, at the local level than it does at the presidential and the other offices. Thank you.
Do I have a question from the floor here? Anybody? Wait, there's somebody right here. Right here. Right. Digital microphone. RBI. What does RBI stand for?
Red Sox Foundation.
I'm sorry?
The Red Sox Foundation.
Ah.
Yeah.
Your name and where you're from and who you like what and who you'd like to answer your question.
I actually would like all of them to.
Okay.
My name is Nelly. I'm from Boston. Well, originally born in Worcester, but from Boston. So I'm a student at Boston Arts Academy. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a racist incident at a concert where a white student airdropped a photo of him. He colored himself black, and the thing was, my school was the only diverse group there, and there was only one black judge. And so I want to know how you guys would react to it.
Well, I'm in Boston, heard about it firsthand. I work closely with the principal there, and I'm even doing folks who are involved in sort of the foundational philanthropic arm for the school. And I was angry. I was disgusted. I felt similar to the students, including yourself, I'm sure. But I will give credit to our interim superintendent at BPS and the president of the University of New Hampshire, who actually stepped up really quick, and former counselor Tito Jackson, who went to UNH to not only make sure that there's a thorough investigation, and that's still going on right now, but also to lend support in different ways to the students, and to call that out. And you know, you can't do that stuff alone. Again, why go back to the point of talking about race, racism? People act like we're, you know, this post-racial society. We are not. Stuff is happening every single day. It's hateful, it's disgusting, it's awful, and usually our young people are on the receiving end of some of this. So kudos to you, the team that went up, the school. But I was angry and I was upset. But then the question I always sort of end with is, well, what are we going to do about it? And I will say the response from the administration, New Hampshire folks, as well as former Councilor Tina Jackson, has been really great and supportive. But it's unacceptable on all fronts.
Kim, I hate to throw the question at you, but you are a mayor. When you have racial incidents crop up, have you figured out a way that's the best way to diffuse or to answer the question directly, or at least deal with the problem directly?
Yeah, and unfortunately, we have had issues in our community. Thankfully, not many, but you have to stand up right away. Whether they're incidents of teenagers or school children, you never know how serious some of these infractions are, where they're coming from. They're normally anonymous, but you treat them seriously. You stand up right away, and there's no space for that whatsoever. I think building cultural competencies, even in communities that are diverse, is still very much a challenge. Implicit bias exists. Having a school system that recognizes that we need to teach those practices, and we need to acknowledge those biases and talk through those issues as a community, and being a strong voice of recognizing that we are going to come to these discussions together. We have a community that stands up when things like this happen to come together, but it's awful. And it doesn't want, nobody wants that to define their community, their school, their class, but the only way we're really gonna be able to overcome that if we're willing to have those conversations when these items are triggered. And unfortunately, they're happening more often, not less often.
Especially within the last few years, I would say. Question?
We have,
Your name and your city, please, or town.
Good evening. First, I wanted to just say thank you for this amazing panel. It's been so enlightening. So thank you for the work that you're doing. My name is Lisa Senka, and I'm the principal of an all-girls high school. We just started the high school this year. It's Malden Catholic School for Girls, and I have four of my amazing students here with me. So I want to give you kudos to them. Malden Catholic has been a boys' school for 85 years. And hello, it's 2019. We need a parallel school for girls, and here we are. And these young women took the opportunity to come to the school to lead it and create a brand new school. They are leading this school with me. And I'm extremely proud of them and also proud of the efforts of our school. I really would like to know, what opportunities do you have or advice can you give me for these young women? Do you offer internships? How can we get them out modeling what you're doing? Because they need role models. They're eager and willing, but what advice can you give them?
And we're talking about high schoolers, is that correct?
Yes, we're ninth graders.
Who wants to tackle this one?
I think students who have an opportunity to participate in an externship, a little bit shorter time frame, or an internship, or even a shadowing opportunity can provide some insights into snapshots and chunk sizes of what's going on. I also think picking an issue and staying with it for the entire year as a school or as a community is something that I think allows a deeper understanding and also obviously fit within curriculum and other needs that you might have.
And from my office, we have an internship program coming up. My legislative aide is here, and he's putting that together, and we are accepting applications from high school students as well as college students. But I think one of the most educational experiences they could have is to work on a campaign to see what's happening on the ground. There are many local elections coming up. That's where they can lend their skill sets and knowledge. But Kim was saying earlier, please reach out to us. I'm more than happy to have them shadow me or come with me to a hearing or go to an event with me. I've also had high school students in my district reach out to me to do informational interviews. And I cannot stress that enough. So I wish I knew this when I was growing up, and I didn't, and I regretted it. But an informational interview is essentially an interview where you reach out to someone who's in a position that you want to be in eventually. And you ask them questions. What do they like about their job? What don't they like about their job? What's their day-to-day like? And that's how you can rule out what you want to do and what you don't want to do. And I encourage you to do that, and please reach out to me. I'm more than happy to do that.
And just give me your name and where you're from, and let me know if you want someone specifically to answer your question.
Well, so since the title is Women in Leadership, then I have to ask, what do you expect from men? Especially since you mentioned this word, Warren, then I have to mention Bernie Sanders. What do you think Bernie can do something different this time to have to get some common good? That's my question.
So I can answer, what do we expect of men? Because it has to be a two-way conversation. Westboro Republican High School, the Westboro High School had a Republican group, and they asked me to come in and meet with them. And they were a great group of young men, and they said, where are the women? And they assured me there were some women who were part of their club. But I said, so what do you do to support women winning? Have you gotten involved in town? Like, what candidates are out there? And really engaging in the conversation and asking about women running and what they think about it. And is there one that they see out there that they think is a particular good candidate that they would like to support? But I think if we are only talking to women about running, that we are leaving half the equation not focused on. And so the more that we can also talk to men about opportunities to get involved and to either help women who are running or to find kind of issues in which they feel that they can contribute to that maybe typically in the past when they look at as women's issues. I mean, I tell folks, women who didn't fight for the right vote to be able to participate in women's issues. They fought for the right vote on health issues. And so I think it's important that we also don't limit ourselves. One of the things at the State House in the past is for many years when women would get assigned to the women's committees, they would be assigned to children and families or elder affairs or education. They wouldn't be assigned to financial services or transportation. So we, having women in office is really important, but making sure those women who are in office are also part of the critical conversations that are going on. Is just as important. And so making sure men are aware of that is not enough to sort of think, more women are getting elected. But are they in the room? Are they part of the important conversations that are going on? And are they able to make an impact in those ways?
I just want to thank you for the question. I think my expectation for men is a partnership, right? I'm married to an amazing individual who never heard about helping care of our children, right? Young children, never babysitting, right? It was just you were there as their dad. I still think mothers tend to be the primary caregivers, making doctor's appointments, making sure. Opportunities to do really hard stuff that were complex and encouraged me to do that work. And I think that partnership can expand to helping a woman network into a field challenges that perhaps have been disregarded or the other way in the past. That's what I'm looking for.
Or simply cook the meals when she's too busy.
Yeah.
particular system for a long period of time. And so I think it's absolutely critical on the issue front. I just wanted to name that.
And to add to that, I talked earlier about women amplifying each other's voices, but men should amplify our voices too. We've heard of instances where, you know, if I say something, no one listens, and then a man says it, and then all of a sudden, what a great idea. Well, what you can do as a man is attribute it back to me and say, actually, Chong said that first. You might want to listen to it. That's how you can help us.
I would just like to point out
regardless of what point you are, what sex you are, what your background is.